wired, buried. He filled the whole backyard up literally with ground plane wires. Now, that was a foreshort. Yes, he experimented. See how short he could go. Now, the question again. Let me let it drop. The question again. A 25-foot pipe. This company here in Germany. I'll give you, I don't know. Yeah, I guess they must have a website on it. Let me see if they got a, who the heck knows where. Oh, yeah, I got his website. They even gave it to me. It's a long, long website, but it's called the DJ2UT Unique Trapless Vertical, 6 meters through 80 meters, continuous tuning with a SWR of under 2 to 1, Dick, over.
Quick comment. Now, let me address that before we pass it over to Wesley. Jerry Civic, W2FMI, and I were on the same dais on at least one occasion. Real smart guy. And when it comes to electrically small antennas, he was reproving something that the amateurs in general strongly disagree with, and that is the so-called infinitesimal dipole, and call it infinitesimal monopole. You read the appropriate chapter of one of the Bibles of the antenna world, the John Krause, WHJK, McGraw-Hill book, 1950, called Antennas. It was used in a ridiculous number of courses in colleges. Extremely good book. Let me drop. And that book, called Antennas, has three separate editions. I've got all three editions. And just like the Antenna Engineering Handbook, it's got four editions. And I got all four editions. I collect antenna books. I'm really interested in the subject, and it puts a lot of meat and potatoes on my table, so to speak. My favorite subject. Anyhow, what Krause's book said is that you can make a dipole, you can make an antenna, as short as you like. Half wave is nice. Quarter wave for a dipole is pretty yucky. Give you a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio. And is that as far as you can go? Uh-uh. You can make the dipole. In theory, you can make a dipole on 80 meters, 10 feet long if you wanted to. It'll have an impedance match that is extremely difficult. But if you're smart enough to devise very low insertion loss, inductor, capacitor, network, you can match that antenna. You talk to the guys that use high power transistors, where sometimes the input impedance of a transistor is half an ohm, and the output impedance of the transistor at their frequency is 1.5 ohms. And you look at the impedance matching that they do, and they can get 95% efficiency out of that impedance match. The bottom line is, no matter how bad, by the way, that half an ohm of input impedance on that transistor on a 50-ohm world is a 100 to 1 standing wave ratio. Some of your really high power transistors do that every day of the week and make it fly with high efficiency. Let me drop. So when you make an antenna infinitesimal in size as far as wavelengths are concerned, the Q goes through the roof. Q means that the antenna becomes extremely narrowband. That's a given. And the impedance match becomes extremely difficult. That's a given. But if you're smart enough to design a good low-loss network, you can take a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio antenna, impedance match it at that single frequency, and get 95% efficiency out of that antenna. That's a given. You tell that to the average amateur, and he says, yeah, I sort of accept that you can transmit with that, but because the antenna is so small, the effector capture area is so small, it's not going to receive. Sounds good and logical. I'll bet you 80% of the guys on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon will tell you that answer. It's not true. That's a violation of reciprocity. Let me drop. The theorem of reciprocity states in no uncertain terms, as long as you're using linear materials, you're not using diodes and transistors and circulators, you're using linear materials, whatever performance you measure on your antenna when it's transmitting, pattern, gain, efficiency, side lobe levels, front to back ratio, whatever you measure on antenna when it's transmitting, by definition of the reciprocity principle, it must have exactly those properties when receiving. So if the antenna had a gain of half a dB above a dipole when it transmitted, even though it's infinitesimal in size, half a dB over isotropic, it will have half a dB over isotropic of receiving gain, and whatever effective capture area that represents, it still will be there. Common sense will ask you, how in the world can an antenna that's only 10 feet long act like the exact same capture area of a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters that has 132 feet of length? How in the world can it have that effective capture area? That is the magic of resonance. You properly establish resonance of that radiating system, it will reestablish that gain, that effective capture area, and all of those properties. The hit that you take is that it's going to be extremely narrow band. Let me drop. You do that infinitesimal dipole in 80 meters, and you tune it for 3.8 megacycles, and you go more than 50 kc high or 50 kc low, the standing wave ratio is going to climb through the roof, and you may not be able to tolerate it unless you've got a very wide-range tuner. But small antennas can do it. So the fact that the antenna is only 25 feet long, if they got the right kind of impedance matching, doesn't stop the physics from doing it. Now, the real thing you're asking, Mel, is when Jerry Civic did his work with very small vertical antennas in his backyard, I think one of his antennas was an 80-meter antenna, and it was probably 10 or 12 feet tall as a monopole, and he had an umbrella on the top of it acting like a top hat capacitor, and he had his wife sitting in a lawn chair underneath it, just to show you what the antenna looked like, set up on his front lawn in New Jersey. Let me drop. Anyway, as long as you've got a large number of radials, that antenna had high efficiency. But now we're getting back to this resistive loading of an antenna. You put an insufficient number of radials of insufficient length so that the earth around that quarter wave ground plane antenna of yours no longer acts like a great big sheet of metal. There's a whole lot of dirt that the RF energy is seeing. That is a resistive loading phenomena of your antenna. Whether you put the resistor in the antenna by way of a attenuator that you put in the transmission line, whether you put it in as a resistor that's right at the base of the antenna, whether you distribute a resistor along the radiator of the antenna or make it out of stainless steel instead of good copper or some other high conductor, or whether you don't put down enough radials so that now you're heating up the dirt in the backyard and the worms are going to be warm in the wintertime, in any of those cases, you're creating a resistive, dissipative structure as part of your antenna. And if half of your power is being radiated by heating up the dirt in your backyard because you didn't put down enough radials, but yet the antenna gives you a good impedance match, that means your antenna has got 50% efficiency. Of the 100 watts you put into it, only 50 watts gets radiated. The average guy will say, that's horrible, I won't tolerate it. Well, for a guy who's got limited resources, doesn't have a big enough backyard, doesn't want to lay down that number of radials, he's now 3 dB weaker, he's half an S unit down on a well-calibrated S meter. Does that put him off the air? Is that a showstopper? Absolutely not. Let me drop. That guy is taking a hit in performance. But nothing is going to burn up. He's not doing anything illegal. His transmitter is not going to be unhappy. His receiver is not going to be unhappy. He's going to get full performance out of the receiver. That's a whole other discussion. He doesn't take a hit on the receiver. He does take a hit on the transmitter power and the amount of signal he's going to present to that DX station when he's trying to get into a pileup. But that is a livable situation. If you're smart enough to know what you're doing, that is very tolerable. It's a very good compromise. It's not a showstopper. It's less than ideal, but you got to now look realistically at what percentages of efficiency are. The average guy, anything less than 90% efficiency, you say, I'm not going to go there. Well, he's being too severe. I've used antennas that have 50% efficiency that do the function very well. And if you're smart enough to know what you're doing, that can fly. That's a whole bunch of opinions. I've been there. I've lived through that. And if you're realistic enough to see the big picture, I say it works. It's not perfect. All of life is a compromise. Nothing is perfect. The only thing left to discuss is how much compromise are you willing to tolerate? And if you understand the situation, you'd be amazed how many compromise situations are very tolerable. And later on, when you've got the money and the time and you build a better house and you got more land and you put up a better antenna and you see the improvement, you'll get a lot of appreciation out of the improvement. But you're not off the air in the meantime. Inter-XJN wants to express some opinion on this. He's going to wait for the beep and then 2 seconds, K2RIW. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet, November. Well, actually, you said everything that I wanted to say. But it is not whether somebody believes if this antenna could be up to 6 meters. It is nothing strange to have one antenna being done and radiating up to 1.2 gigahertz. Somebody is going to laugh from me? Guess what? I'm right. It is efficiency that is important, not the coverage. And to Exia.
KCCUJL.
Go ahead, Tony. And let's see what the guys in Brooklyn have got to say, particularly Canarsie, Brooklyn. You got it, Tony.
Got to say is that you are definitely proficient at what you're doing. You are doing exactly what we used to do years ago. When you had to go down to the FCC to obtain a license, you had to sit down and by memory draw a one-tube transmitter and one-tube receiver. You had to know the Morse code. You had to know how to make your own antenna. So I have to say something to you, Dick, I believe your name is. Honestly, in my 35 years in radio, I think you're a very efficient, proficient person, and I shame on people out there that have a license and don't have the ingenuity or the technology or the mechanic ability to build an antenna. That's from me. KC2UJL, God bless you, and I applaud you. I haven't heard a man speak like you in years. So you should start your own channel right here. And they should bring the code back. KC2UJL.
I have to, in all honesty, tell you that I pay Tony quite a bit of money each month to say those words. This is a joke. Tony, the next check is in the mail. Thank you very much. Okay, glad you appreciate it. Bear in mind now, what you're hearing is a bunch of opinions. Not all of them are perfectly traceable to the Bureau. Like every human being, none of us bats a thousand. We all have a certain error ratio. And you've got to accept that the human condition. Occasionally you're going to make an error. And if you're smart enough to laugh at yourself when you make the error and say, hey, I only make the error 10% of the time and 90% of the time I'm right, that's good enough, laugh at it, and go on. You'd be amazed how many of the engineers I've worked with that if somebody that demonstrates to them that there's one little dent in their armor and they've made one error somewhere in their engineering career, and they will defend it until the cows come home. And they'll say, what I really meant to say was such and such, and what you heard was not what I meant, and so on. You gotta admit we occasionally make an error. And you may think that I've given you a lot of good information. Review it, think it over. Not all of it is perfect. I've made some pretty big errors in my time. But thank you, Tony. Okay, back to you, Mel. Well, we're getting into all kinds of philosophy here tonight. Look what you started, Mel. Look what that guy did. We sent you an email. K2KEY, back to the mailbag, K2IIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I'm reading the advertisement. Now, this is a pricey piece of pipe, Dick. 25 feet of pricey pipe. The antenna is, like I say, a monopole. It says no traps, floating coil, no ground loss, full legal power, no tuning required, 6 through 80 meters. So this is the antenna that they are thinking of. Is it worth the... From what I told you about this monopole, do you think that such a antenna is worth a considerable... This is what they're asking me. Would I suggest investing in such an antenna? Is it going to work anywhere near what you would believe as a professional antenna engineer, the way the advertisement writes it up, Dick, over?
A darn good set of questions you're asking now, Mel. If the antenna contains no loading coils, I was hoping the antenna contained a structure and a resonator within the radiator that brought it electronically up to a half-wave resonator, half-wave radiator. the magic of a half-wave radiator, like a J-pole. When you feed the dipole at the far end, you get some tremendous benefits. An N-fed ZEP antenna was a stroke of genius way back in the turn of the century. We've made very little use of it since. But when you feed the end of the antenna, the bad news is you got an extremely high impedance, something like 1,500 ohms to feed. And if you didn't do any correction on that, there's what, a 75 to 1 standing wave ratio, something really high. But if you're smart enough to do an impedance match between your 50 ohms and the 1,500, you pick up one hell of a benefit, because the impedance that you're feeding at that point on the antenna is so high, the need for the ground plane radials almost disappears. You'd be amazed how many guys will set up a half-wave radiator on the balcony of their apartment at the 20th floor of an apartment building, using nothing as the counterpoise but the metal rail of their balcony, and they're doing that at 20 meters, where the rail is, you know, infinitesimal in wavelengths, and that antenna can fly like a charm. So the magic of a half-wave radiator, once you solve that impedance matching problem, is the ground plane radials become almost a non-requirement. However, could this antenna that's only 25 feet tall be electronically a half-wave radiator, half-wave resonator at that frequency without a hidden loading coil somewhere? That there may be telescoping tubing, there may be a coil somewhere in the side that you don't see it. If it truly is a simple metal pipe, 25 feet long, and you want to use it on 80 meters, that's going to be tough. Without a significant number of ground plane radials, you're going to be lighting up quite a bit of the dirt in the backyard, and the real efficiency, is going to be quite a bit lower. And an unscrupulous antenna manufacturer can get away with that, because very few of us can really measure the efficiency, the radiation efficiency of an antenna when it includes ground loss. If I had transmission line loss, I can easily measure that by putting a watt meter at the far end. Put 100 watts in this end, I get 50 watts out the other end, I know what the loss of that cable is. If the antenna had a resistor built into the antenna, and I run a key down with 100 watts into it, and I run over there and turn it off and find out what gets hot, or look at it with a thermal imaging camera, I can measure the amount of heat the antenna is radiating, and I can get a good estimation of the efficiency that way. But if because of the design of the antenna, the loss is the dirt in my backyard, and it's a volumetric loss that goes down some ridiculous number of feet, and it's heating up the worms, can I now evaluate that loss? That's tough. I didn't say you can't do it, and some smart guy is eventually going to write an article about putting some kind of a voltage probe down into the dirt of his antenna around the ground plane radials, and he's going to be able to come up with what is the real insertion loss of the ground around his antenna, because there's not enough counterpoise system established. And if you know what kind of soil you've got, if you know what percentage of topsoil and sand and loam and clay and whatever, and you go into the right modeling program, you can model that and come up with a pretty good answer, probably a 90% accurate answer, if you know what I mean, 10% error, good enough. But to really measure the amount of loss in your backyard because you don't have enough ground plane radials, that's tough. But if you take the worst case assumption, that half the power is being lost through that, and so I'm 3 dB down in the antenna performance, and I'm willing to go up 3 dB in transmitter power to correct for it, I'm willing to use an amplifier. I'm not a QRP enthusiast, a pure guy like Tony. I'm willing to buy a kilowatt amplifier and radiate 500 watts of it. I'm back in the ball game if I want to be with the big gun guys, so to speak. So it is a livable situation. It is a situation that can be evaluated. With the raw data you and I are given so far, Mel, we don't have enough of the answer, but that's a tough one. One of the things that Mel and I, are very reluctant to do, and one of the most frequent questions we get, particularly from new guys, is, I've got X number of dollars in my pocket. I just got into ham radio. I'm thinking of buying the brand X antenna. It's got this performance. I'm thinking about buying the brand Y antenna. It's got that performance. And these are the prices. Which one should I buy? Mel and I don't get into that one. That's an extremely tough one. It's almost as bad as somebody asking you, I'm about to get married. Should I marry a blonde or a brunette? which one's going to give me more pleasure? And in either of those situations, there's a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye. And so there's no clear answer to that one. I don't think you and I know, even if we had all the data and we know exactly how many dollars or how many Deutschmarks that antenna costs, can we say that the guy should buy it or shouldn't buy it? That's not an easy one to answer. I'll leave that one to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
The magic number is 2 seconds after the courtesy tone beep, and then you won't time out the reflector anymore.
Good information. Okay, we're going to try to honor that one. Wait 2 seconds beyond the beep, Mel.
Okay, wait 2 seconds. I'm watching my stopwatch here. All right, very good. This is K2KEY. So, can we recommend the antenna for $567.34 American, good old American money, for a monopole antenna that stands 25 feet high, has no trap, supposedly no ground loss, on full legal power, no tuning required? There's the answer that we can't give. Am I correct, Dick? Is the, as they say, the jury out on this one? Over.
You, well, let me drop for 2 seconds. You're absolutely right. If that antenna was $56, you and I immediately would say, go for it. If the antenna was $1,000, we'd say, wow, that's pricey. What is it, gold-plated? It's in that gray zone. If the guy has got lots of money, and it's not going to hurt him, go for it. But if it's like, but if he's like the rest of us, most ham radio operators are not the president of a company. They haven't got the deep pockets where money doesn't matter. They don't periodically go to Atlantic City or Las Vegas and drop $50,000 and don't even bat an eyelash. We're not a high roller. We don't fall into that category. We want a lot of bang for the dollar. Our money is valuable to us. We don't have a lot of it. $567 to me is pricey. I personally don't think I would go for it. But there are people out there where the money is not that valuable to them. They got more than they know what to do with. And the fact that it's a no-tune covering all those frequencies, assuming the manufacturer is telling the truth, for that guy with deep pockets, that's not so bad an antenna. I don't think it's a bargain. But that's just me. That's about as close as I can come to giving you an answer. K2KEY, K2RIW, would you buy it, Mel? Wait for 2 seconds.
Let me explain the situation here. You're in a situation where you have no way of putting up any antennas. You're in this condo situation. You have no access to hang up anything. They watch. Let me tell you, I have heard, and right here in Brooklyn, they are looking up the walls of the building. They caught one of the hams here that tried one of these secret antennas that's out his window, you know, wire along the brick wall. And they were looking with binoculars, and they spotted him, and they told him to take it down, and he did put it back up again. Well, he got fined. He was fined this time. Told the next time they're actually going to sort of, I guess, sort them out. So then comes along other people that have a modest backyard and a number of these condo-type houses here that they've been building. They're more or less, you know, not high stacks, like only two floors, but they are, I mean, they drop. But they are condos. But if you went ahead and you stuck something up that looked like a flagpole, actually hung a American flag on it, you're most likely not going to get much flack. So supposedly, the attractiveness of this antenna is very nonchalant looking. You would not look at it and say it is an antenna. You don't have to do digging up of the landscape, really. Maybe just sneak one wire, you know, direct burial piece of coax or something, you know, a short distance from where the antenna is standing into your house. This is where the attractiveness of these type of antennas are coming into play, Dick. It's how else were you going to put up something for 80 meters or 40 meters in a situation like this? Over.
Okay, I hear you. You're saying it for a guy in a tough environment who wants to be on ham radio, but doesn't want the zoning board coming down on him and the neighbors coming down on him, it is a compromise solution. So, not ideal. I'm a little bit too frugal to spend that kind of money for an antenna, particularly because in many cases the raw materials involved are not that expensive. And we amateurs are extremely good at building antennas and fiddling with them and tweaking them and experimenting with them and so on. That's where we really shine. We don't build our rigs anymore, except up on the VHF, correction, the UHF, SHF frequencies. There you got to build. You got no choice. And that's where the frontier in ham radio is, by the way. Bunch of real fun people up there. But it's a compromise solution. It's a little bit pricey by my standards. But nowadays, a good 2-meter 440 all-mode rig is around $2,000. I don't pay those prices, but a hell of a lot of guys do, and they're very happy for doing it. And the nice thing is if they choose the right brand name that's got a good reputation, if they don't like it a year later, they can get a significant amount of their money back. It's an investment. It's almost money in the bank. So there's lots of ways of doing it. So I probably wouldn't go for it because I've got other resources. But would you, Mel, put that antenna on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach in Brooklyn? Would you put that there and pay that price? I'm really cornering the poor guy. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Well, if you're very involved in ham radio, you're going to grab at straws. Like you say, you'll plunk down a couple $1,000s for a transceiver today. Anything in a decent world is a good couple thousand bucks. And now you've got this nice transceiver. And if you don't have an antenna, you just threw away your $2,000. It's just not going to help you, you know, get you on the air. So here comes along somebody offering you an antenna that's nonchalant and supposedly, according to the advertisement, works extremely well, sold there in Germany, and got some rave remarks about it there. What can I say? To me, I can't, like you say, the material-wise, I can't see where the money is, but listen, like you said, listen, the gentleman who owns the company, I guess, can ask anything he wants for it, even though maybe he's got very little in the material value into it, Dick. Over.
Okay. I think we've answered that one about as best we can with the information we have so far. Go ahead, Wesley.
If you had two antennas, one is cubical quad, two elements, and the other one is Yagi antenna, two elements, on 20 meters, because you like DX sync, which antenna would you choose?
Yeah, that is a... Let me drop. That is a question that has been around ham radio in the United States for at least 30 solid years. A guy named Wayne Overbeck, K6YNB, K6 Yankee, November Bravo, did a very serious set of experiments on that one. He set up a telescoping tower on a trailer with a known good antenna on the top with a rotator, and he visited many of the big gun HF ham radio operators in California, and he parked that vehicle, I'm not sure if he did it a quarter mile or a mile or whatever, from many of those stations where there was a significant argument going on in Southern California. Is a cubical quad better than the same number of elements of Yagi? And so quite a few of those guys had Yagis, quite a few of those guys had cubical quads, and he went out and made real measurements. How strong was the signal a mile away from each one of those stations when measured with his telescoping tower as he parked it on each one of those hillsides, so to speak? The bottom line of all that data is the difference was extremely small. Let me drop. Good common sense would lead you to believe that when you look at a cubicle quad and you're a ham radio operator that sees the wire even though the rest of the public doesn't see wire. And you look at all of that stuff in the cubicle quad. It looks like it's got a lot of area to it. And you look at the same number of elements of Yagi, and it looks like it's got very little area to it. But you're using your optical eyes to look at it, not your radio eyes. If you're smart enough to figure out what does that radio signal see, when you look at that 80-meter dipole, for instance, I'm going to give you a good example, an 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long. It casts a shadow on the ground at high noon of about 1 square foot. The real wire has an optical area of 1 square foot. But when it is operating correctly, impedance matched and resonating at 80 meters, I can prove to you quite a few different ways by the mathematics. Let me drop. That half-wave wire 14-gauge dipole, 132 feet long, has an effective receiving area, effective capture area, of 8,500 square feet. And I'm not kidding. If your eyes operated at that radio frequency and you looked at that antenna, you would see a great big black oval in space around that antenna that would be approximately 140 feet wide and something like 60 feet high. It would be a great big oval in space that with horizontally polarized energy at 3.7 megacycles coming into that antenna, everything in that black area is absorbing the RF energy. By the resonance phenomena, it appears on that wire, it goes down that feed line, and it pegs that S-meter. So that simple wire that you see with your eye has a hell of a lot more capture area, 8,000 to 1 ratio more than what your eye sees. If you use that exact same phenomena, that exact same philosophy, and you look at a cubicle quad, and you look at a Yagi, and you look at it with RF eyes, the difference is nowhere near what you think it is. The bottom line on a two-element quad versus a two-element Yagi, maybe the answer is 0.6 dB of difference, 0.3 dB of difference. I'm not sure. You go back to Wayne's article, which was in Ham Radio Magazine. You can read the results of his real set of measurements. Let me drop. So it really comes down to which mechanical construction technique do you prefer? How much wind loading difference are you willing to live with? What you see in your eye and what you see with the radio is quite different, and the difference is not great. You can argue till the cows come home that there's a whole lot more area to the cubicle quad. It's really two vertically stacked antennas. One's an inverted V up and one's an inverted V down. You can go through all those arguments. You can convince yourself that the cubicle quad is going to be 3 dB ahead of the same number of elements of a Yagi. You can easily convince yourself of that. You go out in the field like Wayne Overbeck did, and you make the measurements. It does not confirm. I wonder if it surprises you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW. Wait for the beep plus 2 seconds.
I was actually expecting exactly that answer. I just didn't believe that you're going to point it that way. The only way I could add to it is if you can say a few words about... I specifically ask you about de-exing and just by looking at the characteristic of cubical quad in terms of de-exing comparing to Yagi and to XM.
Okay, the total amount of... Let me drop for 2 seconds. The total amount of the effective capture area of those two antennas, cubicle quad versus Yagi, is extremely similar. The amount of real estate you've established, by real estate I mean how many wavelengths wide, how many wavelengths high, how many wavelengths deep. The total number of wavelengths of real estate you've established in those two antennas is extremely similar, and the difference in wavelengths of real estate is so small, the difference, that if I now go and calculate front-to-back ratio with a real design, with a good design, that's a wash. Calculate forward lobe, main lobe beam width, that's a wash. Calculate side lobe levels, they're close. Calculate vertical beam width, they're close. So in the real DX world, if both of those antennas, the same altitude above the ground, radiate the same gain, same beam width, same vertical elevation angle, same front to back ratio, if it's a good design, properly tuned, I don't think there's going to be a DX difference. You say those words on 20 meters. You talk to a guy who is invested with a cubicle quad, he'll give you 50 reasons why everybody who's not using a cubicle quad is crazy. Talk to another guy who's used Yagis all of his life, as long as everybody hasn't given him a whole lot of flack, he'll tell you how much better a Yagi is as far as surviving the wind load and the ice and everything else. Cubicle quads that are not built real nice or real well end up with fatigue failure at the four corners and the wire breaks off and whatever. So each has its advantages in the guy's mind. Is there a real difference in the real DX world with proper designs? I doubt it. I don't think it's enough worth fighting for. If you prefer one over the other, mechanically, weather-wise, survival, life and whatever, and dollars of investment, wind load, go for it. But if you think that one is going to allow you to win in a pileup compared to the other, as you can tell, Wesley, I'm very doubtful. I'm waiting for more objective evidence for some other result of that particular question. And 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet, wait for 2 seconds.
K2JL.
Okay. November, 2X3, November. Well, it was found in Europe. I mean, European guys for cubicle quads. In America, the Yagi's antennas are more popular. And knowing that there is a much greater population of ham radio operators in Europe just because of so many countries, and they are actually very densely populating Europe, it was found that cubicle quad behaves better in terms of bouncing between ionosphere and stratosphere. It's just that for some reason, I didn't need to read the article, but it was a very common sense, that was a lot of publication in this area. The cubicle quad is just more efficient in terms of DXing.
Okay. I have no doubt that the Europeans, talking to each other, expressed that opinion, sincerely felt that that is the truth, and they believe it. I have no doubt. Is it real? Were those measurements made in a way traceable to the Bureau? We all are subjective. If I just spent $567 for an antenna, and if I believe the advertising brochure, I'm going to go on the air and tell people how great this antenna is, and I made the right decision. Maybe yes, maybe no. There are ways of making measurements traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Until somebody does that, I'm a little skeptical, as you can tell. But Tony's going to clear this up for us. Maybe Tony has used a cubicle quad. KC2, UJL, K2RIW. Wait for the beep, and you got it, Tony.
Okay, Dick, before I sign off, you got to remember Mr. Coily. People remember Mr. Coily? How many people did he rip off with his antennas before he disappeared into the Outer Limits someplace with his antennas? You know, you're talking about things that are just basic science in radio radio technology. Every radio operator that operates radio should know all about this already. If not, there's a great library you can get. It's full of books. You know, years ago, when I was a young kid, you had to find a Dutch uncle that was a ham operator that would take you under his wing and teach you this stuff. And the only way he would teach you this stuff is if you took a mop and a pail and you washed all his stairs from the top floor to the bottom floor. You know, Dick, you're a very nice man. Next time I come on, I'll tell you how you make an antenna for 2 meters and 440 with a welding rod and a coffee can. Other than that, Dick, you're definitely a great person. I've never met you. I don't know you. I know Larry Moonbounce. I remember Larry Moonbounce used to bounce signals off the moon. Going back years ago, you know. So I just recently got my ham license, but I had my ham license many years ago, but I lost it. So what can I say to you? Dick, it was a pleasure meeting you, sir. And there's a lot of people out there, if you don't belong to the ARRL, if you're not getting the books, well, you should get them. There's a lot of good ideas in there. If you live in a condominium and they won't let you put an antenna, well, then move. What can I tell you? If you really like the hobby. Because no matter how you put it, you can go out and spend $100,000 on a transceiver. The antenna is 99.9% of the radio. Without that, you can buy the best radio in the world. Dick, God bless you, and good night. KC2UJL.
Yeah, along those lines of what you just said, Tony, nowadays, by way of the Internet, 98% of the information there is really beautiful stuff. You use the right search words, you'll find all kinds of books and articles and illustrations and animations that'll show you how radio works. That helps a lot. There are a fair number of good books. Unfortunately, I'm occasionally asked by people, hey, you seem to know something about antennas. What book should I go to that's really going to make it nice and clear to me how an antenna works and how to design one? That's a tough one. There aren't that many books that make it clear. ARRL antenna book comes close. The JASIC or the Lackus or Johnson Antenna Engineering Handbook will help a lot. The Krauss book on antennas will help a lot. Does any one book really make it clear? No. It's not an easy subject, I'll warn you. When it comes to people meeting me, let me drop. I went to the Levittown Hall flea market today of Limark, and I sat alongside of Andy, WA2CDL, the guy who does the antenna tune-ups, rig tune-ups and checking. And I intended to sit there for a couple of minutes and walk around the place and see what's being sold. And a couple of people stopped in and started the conversation. 5 hours later, I was still sitting there talking to people. Never got a chance to walk around the hall. Never got a chance to buy anything. Had this great big pile of money in my pocket. I wanted to spend it. Never got a chance to do that. A little bit of an exaggeration there. But it was fun. Got into some real good conversations. Boy, in one of those conversations, we got deep into medicine. Another one, we got deep into antennas, philosophy of ham radio. We didn't settle anything, but a lot of discussions took place. It was fun. Okay, Mel, go to your next mailbag. We got enough time for at least one more. K2KEY, K2RIW, wait for 2 seconds.
Okay, this is K2KEY, all right? Let me tell you the story on the quad before we leave it, because this I have a considerable amount of knowledge because I delved into this some years ago. The cubicle quad was invented by a gentleman by the name of Clarence Moore. He was W9LZX. Invented it in the 1940s. Along came, then the controversy started building up, a quad versus a Yagi. And the guy who put the whole thing to rest was a guy by the name of Jay Lindsay, W7ZQ, W7ZQ. What he did, set up on equal towers on his property a two-element quad and a two-element Yagi. He did it, first of all, he did it originally on 20 meters, and then they started, and he got his results, published his results, and he says, and people would say, well, you'll try it, you'll see how much better it'll be as you go higher in frequency. At that time, the higher frequency, of course, was 10 meters. He did the same experiment on 10 meters. And the answer was, let me let it drop. He found there was no difference in working with either or antennas. However, the quad did exhibit something strange. The band seemed to open a little earlier and close a little later with the quad. Also, he found that the noise level was less. Not a heck of a lot, but there was a pronounced difference in a lower noise level with the quad dick. That's what I'll say so far about this subject. And like you say, let's jam one more in before we go over.
Beautiful answer.
Now, I believe that measurement, that compact comparison of noise between Quad and Yagi could be real. But there's a catch. Not too many amateurs really understand what is the true purpose of a high-quality balancing device. If you've got a real good balance, such that your driven element of your Yagi, the dipole section, is really being fed correctly with that coax, so that the coax cable itself is not doing any of the radiation, which really means by reciprocity picking up noise. The coaxial cable can pick up noise. Give me a real good balance that the antenna is being fed in a truly balanced manner, so that only the noise hitting the antenna, not the noise hitting the cable, is present. Under those conditions, because it is easier to feed the Quad with a poor balance than it is to feed a Yagi with a poor balance, that could be the difference. If a really good balance was done in both cases, I think even that noise difference would disappear. That's a belief, but I haven't done it, so I'm not positive. But go on to your next mailbag, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, this was done under the auspices of a university. I believe he was a professor of electrical engineering out there. Where was he? I think in the state of Washington. Yes, state of Washington, Jay Lindsay. And he was also working with Walt Maxwell at the time. W2DU was also involved in this experiment. I have all the paperwork on it. I dig it up sometimes. Very, very interesting how they made measurements. In fact, you know, they did some of the measurements right up at the antenna. It was amazing what they did. They were using, actually, they had some kind of instrument. They were measuring field strength, I believe, up at the antennas and using a spy scope, you know, one of these rifle scopes to view the results. I got some very unusual pictures on this thing. This was quite an involved experiment that was done some years ago, Dick. We'll get into another time. Okay, shall we try one more real quick? Over.
Yes, we should. And to throw in a couple more words, if the antenna has a properly constructed cubical quad set up for horizontal, we'll have purely horizontal polarization. So does a properly set up Yagi. So if the polarization is identical, if the gain is identical, if the front to back ratio is identical, if the 3 dB beam width is identical, and if the feed line is not involved in the antenna operation as far as the outside of the feed line picking up noise, then there should be no difference in noise. So even though these guys have got great credentials and did a very serious experiment, I've learned an awful lot in the last year and a half on the subject of balance. There are balance and there are balance. If the guys had a really good, thoroughly balanced balancing structure so that the feed line itself, assuming it was coax cable, was not involved in the antenna characteristics, then I'm troubled by what could the mechanism be for a difference in noise. You see where I'm going on that one. So we've learned a lot in the last few years. Jerry Civic is one of the guys that helped us learn that, about what is a good balance. There's only an infinite number of ways of making a bad balance. Go on to the next one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I won't debate that. The only thing I will question is why the antennas at the same height, why would the band open earlier and stay open later with the quad? Just give me a quick answer on that. What would you say is the answer to that, Dick? Over.
Noise. If one antenna is picking up a lot more local noise because of an imperfect balance and the feed line is picking up his power line noise and whatever, then with that noise in the background, you'll think the band is not yet open. That's my best guess. But if they got the same pattern, the real signal getting to that antenna with the same gain, in theory, there can't be a difference. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, I don't think noise was a problem. If this was done out in the field, that there was nothing nearby at all. I don't know if that was a factor, but they sort of confirmed that for some reason that they found that with DX stations. Okay, Here's a question that's come in a number of times. We've mentioned a number of times, I know two or three people have asked me this, about Andrew's Helix cable. Is it an advantage to use 7/8 cable by 450 megahertz over half-inch Andrew's Helix on 450? What do you suggest, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. No difference. I mean, no question. Andrew Helix, that's the way they pronounce it. The Andrew Company in Illinois, believe it or not, is the largest manufacturer on planet Earth of RF amplifiers. Maybe they're the largest manufacturer of coaxial hardline cables. Not quite sure on that one. They make a lot of antennas. They make a lot of stuff. Really big company. Anyhow, Andrew Helix on 432, the 7/8 inch Andrew Helix, I think runs 9/10 of a dB per 100 feet. The half inch Helix, I think runs something like 1.5 dB per 100 feet. So is there a difference in insertion loss because of the diameter? Absolutely, positively. And if you're doing a very serious moon bounce experiment and you want every one of those watts to get to the antenna, because that's an extremely difficult thing to do. The guys I talk to who are really serious about that branch of the hobby, half-inch cable, they'll use it as the receiver structure if and only if there's a line-driving preamplifier for receiving at the antenna. Seven-inch cable, a few of them will use it. The serious guys are using inch and 5/8 Andrew Helix. I think the stuff is something like $50 a foot, or some crazy number like that. The really serious moon bounce guys are going for inch and 5/8 diameter cable, air filled with pressurization, because it gives them 4/10 of a dB per 100 feet. Does diameter buy you performance when you're looking for the last little bit of performance? Absolutely. Is that dB or so of performance worth all those extra dollars? That depends on how deep your pocket is and what you're trying to do. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, so you say that it is an advantage. Let me make sure you say it correct. There is an advantage to 7/8 Andrew's Helix on 450 megahertz. Confirmed, over.
Is there an advantage of Andrew Helix used at the 7/8 inch versus a half inch on 450 megacycles? If you...
W2HCB.
More important things to be doodly doing.